This is Sports Jam, and I'm Doug Doyle. We're here at the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls, New Jersey, on the campus of Montclair State University. And what a thrill it is to have Lindsay Berra, the sports journalist and the oldest granddaughter of Yogi Berra, joining us on the show. Lindsay, we had a chance to spend some time together recently at St. Benedict's Prep for a media event with the students. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you, too. Thanks for coming out.
This is really the spot that a lot of people come to really celebrate the life of Yogi Berra. You're a member of the board here. What is special about this museum?
There's a lot of things that are special about it. First of all, what I immediately think of is that when we first built it 20 years ago, Grandpa said, he used to love coming here and used to tell people, usually when you have a museum, you're dead. And he was very excited that he could be around to see his museum. The New Jersey Jackals and the Montclair State baseball team both play on the field that is adjacent to us here. And Grandpa used to come and just sit outside in our skybox and watch batting practice. He just loved being around baseball. He would come here and kind of sneak up on kids who were here in school groups and go up behind one of them that was like maybe touching a bat and say, "Hey, kid, stop touching my stuff." He really liked to be here and be involved. But now that he's gone, it is such a, it's so emblematic of the life that he lived and his legacy. And we have all this cool stuff here. We have his World Series rings. We have his MVP plaques, gloves and jerseys and things like that. But we definitely like to put the emphasis on the Learning Center part of things here. Grandpa, teamwork, leadership, treating people with respect and embracing diversity and being a humble person, all those things that were very representative of what Grandpa was. And we teach those values to kids in character education programs here. And I think that's the biggest part of his legacy that lives on in this place. And it's great to see. It's been here for 20 years. We get so many kids coming through all the time. And I know he would just love what's been going on here lately in his absence.
We're going to talk a lot about your grandfather, but we really want to talk about you today. You've been a sports journalist for a long time, and you spent 13 years at ESPN as a senior writer there, have been on MLB Network. You specialize a lot when it comes to sports injuries and things like that. What got you into the telling the stories of injuries? I love that article that you did about the problems with Tommy John surgery and things like that. What interests you about that? I think to me, there's a hole out there that a lot of people aren't talking about.
Yeah, it's funny. I had an editor-in-chief at ESPN Magazine who was just a senior editor when I got there. He became the editor-in-chief. His name is Gary Belsky. And I started at ESPN Magazine. I was only 21 years old, and I really learned to write features there at ESPN. And Gary was so great with teaching me things like how to write and how to report and whatnot. But he early on said that I had a way of describing the way athletes move and the biomechanics of sports that other writers just didn't get. And I think it probably came from the fact that I was an athlete my entire life and I really understood how my body moved in things, and I was sort of able to ask them more pointed questions about what they were doing physically and what it felt like and that chain that has to happen in your body. And I became pretty good at writing about it. And then when I went to Major League Baseball, they really had a hole in that injury section of coverage. They didn't have anyone who understood, why a UCL was important to a pitcher or why a groin injury is really bad for a catcher. Like, they didn't have people who could put that two and two together. They could tell you the guy got hurt, but couldn't really tell you in a prolonged look way why that was bad for a player and how it would affect him going forward. So that kind of became, my wheelhouse at MLB.
At that point, when you started your career, there weren't nearly as many women involved when it came to reporting. So did you have any challenges that faced you in that regard?
When I first started at ESPN, I was 21 years old. I started as a fact checker there. And there was a woman in the hockey department who left very shortly after I got there. And I had played ice hockey my entire life, and the hockey editor, I had already made friends with him, and he said, "Well, just hire her. I don't have to teach her anything." So I started covering hockey nationally at ESPN as a 21-year-old, and I think I was one of only three women covering hockey nationally at the time. Hockey was a nice way to kind of make your way into covering professional sports because the people are super nice. It's that, you know, that very blue collar Canadian, like there's just nice people playing hockey, and not that they're not nice people in other sports, but hockey was, it was great. It was not without its challenges. There were, you know, the handful of hockey players who would come out of the shower wearing a towel and see that it was a woman waiting to interview them and hang the towel on the hook and walk over and talk to you. And I used to make sure to ask those players, if I had only one or two questions for them, I made sure to ask them 10 or 12 to make them stand there and feel uncomfortable. But it definitely, as I mean, God, it's been 22 years now. There's so many more women covering now, and it's so much more accepted. It's better now.
But I think you should take some great pride in that yeah. You were one of the leaders in that, being able to deal with, as you said, put the towel, because I saw it, right? I was in locker rooms and I saw that kind of activity going on. If you didn't, you know, do your job and do it professionally, you open the doors for a lot of other people. Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I guess. It was funny. At the time, I think I was 21. In retrospect, I think about it more, obviously. But at the time, I was 21. I was young. I was trying to kind of break in and make a name for myself. And it was the whole, like, Nuke LaLouche, happy to be here. I'm just happy to be here. Do what I can to support the team. And that was the way I viewed working at ESPN. So I was just kind of trying to keep my head down and go about my business and do things right. But it was a bigger challenge to do things right when you had those extra challenges that the guys didn't have, for sure.
You call yourself a multi-platform storyteller, mm-hmm. and I think that's perfect, because yeah. to me, telling stories, I always tell my students about, it's the stories that people remember, it's not the facts and figures. Mm-hmm. Tell a good story and it will be remembered.
Yeah. My best friend Alyssa Ronick is a writer at ESPN. She's still there. And we always used to say, we just want to tell good stories. We don't have to run the place. And when the internet really started to become a thing, when in the late 90s and early 2000s when we were at ESPN, you had to find a way to tell the story in a magazine that would possibly be picked up in a dentist's office a year later. So the story had to be somewhat evergreen for the magazine. You would write a takeout that was kind of newsworthy for the .com. It would be a little shorter, probably. Social media starts to come around, and you've got to tell the story on Instagram and on Twitter. And it's a different way. You could tell the story in photos, and that's what I love doing, taking one story and picking, you know, eight different ways to tell that same story. And when you do it visually, it's very different than when you do it with words, but you're still getting the point across to the people who might digest this information in all these different ways.
You talked about being an athlete at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where you played both softball and hockey. Mm-hmm. You know, doing some research into the life of your grandfather, I thought it was so fun and so interesting that his first date with your grandmother, Carmen, was at a hockey game.
Yeah.
And it must have put some sort of hockey gene into this Barra family. And then you were able to play on the men's club team there at the University of North Carolina. Have you ever thought about that connection, that they went on this date to a hockey game?
So it even started earlier than that. Grandpa, his father, Grandpa Pietro, my great-grandfather, and Joe Garagiola's father worked in the brickyards in St. Louis on the Hill. And they made the bricks that they used to build the St. Louis arena, which was down the hill from the hill where the St. Louis Flyers played. So Grandpa always used to tell people that his father and Joe's father built the arena. Now, they didn't actually physically build it, but they made the bricks that built it. And Grandpa used to play in the off seasons. We actually have some photos in the museum that I can show you. He would skate with the St. Louis Flyers. And there's a famous story, a photo of him on skates with the Flyers appeared in the St. Louis paper, and someone cut it out and put it in the mail and sent it to George Weiss, who was then the general manager of the Yankees, who had signed, you know, Grandpa, and Grandpa was his budding superstar catcher, and Grandpa got a telegram, get your ass off those skates, because he didn't want him to get hurt. But so Grandpa always had this lifelong love of hockey. There's some great video of him and Phil Rizzuto at the 1958 Stanley Cup Finals, where they're talking about the game and he's analyzing Richard and the Bruins puck movement. He really was very knowledgeable about it.
The turning point in the game so far is the two penalties. But although I think Boston is out playing Montreal tonight, they're holding the puck a little bit better than Montreal is.
They have quite a bit of drive tonight, Yogi. I don't think there's any doubt that they deserve their lead, and they are ahead by a score of 2-0. What about the crowd, Yogi? How would this compare for an athlete to a baseball game?
Well, this here, you got to be enthused because there's so much body contact in this game, and there's a lot of wonderful plays in hockey. You see the pass work when they form the line, and see a right winger or left winger go up there. It's really exciting.
Later in life, he becomes friendly with John McMullen, who owned the Colorado Rockies when they were the hockey team, brought them to New Jersey as the Devils. And when I was 5 years old, when they first came here in 1982, my grandpa took me to my first professional hockey game. And right around the same time, my parents had gotten divorced, and my mom, this was like, must have been before Dyfus was a thing, because she used to drop my brother and me off at South Mountain Arena where the Devils practiced, and we would go to the public skating sessions, like from 2 to 4, and she would go and do her grocery shopping and then come back and get us. She would just leave her 5-year-old and her 3-year-old at the rink. So I learned to skate right around the same time Grandpa was taking me to these Devils games, and I just really fell in love with hockey. And when I got to high school, and I had played boys hockey growing up, just because there wasn't a lot of girls hockey at the time, because I'm old, and when I wanted to try out for the hockey team, Grandpa was, you know, all behind it. Go, you show him, you know. He was always super supportive of it and loved to come watch me play. He would go down and work out at the Devils practice facility, which was my high school home rink, and he would pop his head out with Lou Lamoriello, and they would sit at the end of the rink and watch my high school hockey games. It was great. It was always a family affair.
You told the students at St. Benedict's Prep that not only did you play hockey there at University of North Carolina, but you've also had an opportunity to get a couple of assists from the person who's considered at least one of the greatest players of all time, Wayne Gretzky. Tell us that story.
That was when I was with ESPN, I think it was 2004. I was invited to play in Wayne Gretzky's fantasy camp, which at the time was in Arizona. I think it's in Vegas now. But there were a lot of great, famous NHL players. Paul Coffey, which was, he's incredible. Phil Esposito, Glenn Anderson, the Courtnall brothers, and Wayne. And they rotated you. Wayne rotated through the teams that were there. So you got to play, everybody got to play with him. And I happened to be on his team a couple of different times. But one of the ways that I was able to, you know, get away with playing with guys who were so much bigger and stronger and faster than I was that I was smart, and I would get to the spot where I needed to be, do what I needed to do, and then get out of dodge before anyone could catch me to get hurt, you know. So Wayne just quickly realized that when he would think about where he wanted to pass the puck, this chick was always there. So I would be, you know, back door at the goal, and he would like thread a pass through, you know, 8 different pairs of legs, and really all I had to do was redirect it into the back of the net, and I probably scored 5 or 6 goals with assists from Wayne, and it was pretty fantastic. But I didn't have to do much.
Garen inside the 4-man defensive box. It's played to Ralston. Ralston flipped one across, and spanning on it was Niedermeyer. And back out comes Wayne Gretzky. Gretzky moving ahead, picks up Olsen, fights his way free, score! First goal of the game goes to Wayne Gretzky, shorthanded.
Hillary Knight was on here on Sports Jam and had a chance to interview a couple other members of the team. You kind of feel like you just came around just a little bit too soon. You could have been playing in maybe those Olympic Games.
It was funny that 98 was the inaugural one, and I drove up from North Carolina to Walpole, Massachusetts, and did a regional tryout for that first team. But they kind of had their team set, like from the programs and whatnot, and it was more like, I think they were sort of more symbolic tryouts, but it was super fun, and it was nice to be there and see all these women, because I had been the only girl on my teams all growing up. And I go to Walpole, and there's like 300 girls there, you know, doing this regional tryout, and it's like, oh my God, look at all these other girls who are like me. Where have you been all my life? We could have had a team, you know? And then maybe 10 years later, I would say it got really, really big, and now girls have the chance to play, you know, with other girls all from the time they're little, you know.
The Lamoureux twins told me during the show that they, you know, they've got to play with their brother, and mom would have to yell, you know, it's time for dinner. They never wanted to get off the ice. I'm sure you were just like that too. Who was the first person to put a stick into your hand?
It's funny. I was when my mom was dropping me off at the rink, I had figure skates, and I made friends with all these kids there, and they very quickly started making fun of my white, dainty little figure skates, and I asked for hockey skates, and it was probably Grandpa getting me like used equipment from the Devils and cutting down sticks. But I very shortly after that started playing in like the house league at South Mountain Arena. So it was probably a mix of my mom and dad having to deal with me saying I want black skates, not white skates, and then me wanting to play hockey, and then Grandpa facilitating with the equipment guys from the Devils.
You're listening to Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. My guest is sports journalist Lindsay Barra, who is also the oldest grandchild of legendary Yankees catcher Yogi Berra. Let's head back to the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center and find out more about Lindsay's career at North Carolina. What do you remember most about your softball days at UNC?
So, it's funny. So, I played in high school at Livingston High School here in New Jersey. And I was recruited by some D3 teams, and I had kind of decided that I probably wasn't going to play softball in college, and I was going to go to journalism school. And I secretly had done some research into the softball team at UNC, and they were a Division I team. And it's hard to walk on to a D1 team. But I made some calls, and I found out that they did have an open tryout every year, and I didn't tell anyone in my family that I was going to do it because I didn't want anybody's expectations to be high. I didn't even want them to be bothering me about it, especially because, you know, you're just getting to college, and your parents want you to concentrate on your studies and make the adjustment to being away from home. They don't want you to also worry about trying out for a sports team that you hadn't planned to try out for. So I go to a couple weeks of tryouts with the softball team, and I end up making the team. The hitting was very difficult. We had girls who threw 70 miles an hour, but I was a really good outfielder, and they couldn't drop anything by me. So I make the team. I call my father, and I say, "Hey, Dad, I'm going to play softball." And he goes, "Oh, that's great. They have an intramural team?" And I said, "No, Pop, it's not an intramural team." "Oh, it's club. That's so cool. What schools do you get to play against?" And I'm like, "No, Pop, it's not club either." And he's like, "You walked onto a Division I varsity softball team?" And I'm like, "Thanks for the vote of confidence, Dad. Yes, I did." And anyway, so yeah, that was how it went. And it was really fun. I didn't only play for 2 years. I had started to really get into the hockey thing, and then I was doing a lot of stuff in the journalism school and just decided to concentrate on that after it. But playing for those 2 years was a really great experience.
I like the fact that you didn't let them know as you were going through. That's really fun that he got to experience that with you. Now, your dad played in the minor league organizations for the Mets organization. Of course, your Uncle Dale played for the Pirates, Yankees, and Astros. And your other uncle played for the Baltimore Colts.
Yep.
So what is it about this Berra gene that really just, I mean, true greatness has come through you, Lindsay?
I think it was just that we didn't do a lot of sitting around, you know? Like when you went to holidays, we were always playing football in the yard or wiffle ball outside. So the kids just, you know, my uncles and my dad grew up just playing stuff all the time. There's great photos of Grandpa throwing the football in the front yard, and you know, they had a pool, they had a tennis court, like they were always just doing stuff outside. And that was the way we were raised too. My mother also was a really good athlete. She was my mom's water broke with me actually at 29 weeks because she was riding her bicycle like 60 miles a day. and she actually was also flying. She flew home with my dad from the playoffs in Kansas City, and her water broke on the plane in 1977. But she had been riding her bike a ton, like doing a lot more than most pregnant women are supposed to do. She played racquetball. So I kind of got the athletic genes from both sides of my family. My mother's father was he lost a leg in World War II, but he was a basketball and football official, was the president of IABO. When you look at the referees with the patches on their chest, that national organization is IABO, and my grandfather, with his wooden leg, was the president of IABO, reffing basketball and football games all over the country and all over the world, actually.
You were destined to be in that. You had no choice, I guess, at that point. It was in you. You had to bring it out. You know, let's talk a little bit about the stories that you enjoy covering now in the sports world.
Our third strike, Gerrit Cole walks off the mound, striking out the side.
Gerrit Cole just signed with the Yankees for mega money.
For all the money. There's no money left. It's all the money. It's all. If you need some, ask Gerrit Cole.
Tell us, I mean, is it out of control? The salaries that Strasburg and Cole are getting?
No, but it doesn't matter what we think. It's what it is. It's totally out of control, and it's totally where it's going to be, you know? It's just, I can't when – you wonder what Steven Strasburg is thinking right now, because if he had just held out a little longer, would he have left Washington? I don't know. But, I mean, I think Gerrit Cole got $9 million a year more? Strasburg signed for 27 and Cole for 36? I mean, that's crazy. That's completely insane. That's more than $1 million to start.
Is it ever going to come to a point where fans are going to say, I think fans seem to be okay with it right now.
It's not their money. I don't think it's real to them, you know? Like, when you say $36 million a year, I mean, I know what it means, but I can't really wrap my brain around it. I don't actually know what that means. That's crazy. It's a crazy, inconceivable amount of money. So I don't know. I mean, the fans just want to see the product on the field. They want their ticket prices not to go through the roof, and if that happens, I think they're and if you win, they're happy, right?
I think of Yogi and I think of Mickey Mantle, and I think, what kind of money would they have made in today's
world?
People
tell me, Grandpa's best year, he made $58,000. People tell me he'd be unpayable in this market, especially given how much he won, how much he brought to a club. But, like, unpayable, I mean, that's insane. It's totally insane.
So you're given the assignment from whatever outlet it may be, and you've worked for many different networks and wrote stories for many different outlets. They said, Lindsay Berry, you get to write about anything you want to write about in today's society. What's the story that you haven't done that you want to do?
It's funny. I was thinking about one yesterday that I really want to do, and it would be probably an unpopular one. I like to, like, get into the whys of things and whatnot, and I am fascinated. We all know it's been written about so much, how much the strikeout rate has increased in baseball, how many more times players are striking out per year, per game. It's crazy. For my grandfather struck out only 400 and some times in his entire career. Bryce Harper got to 400 strikeouts, I think, in his third year. You know, and you see guys in 1950 was one of my grandfather's best years, 656 plate appearances. He hit, I'm going to mess this up, but he hit around 322, 28 home runs, and he struck out 12 times in the entire year. And you see guys strike out 12 times in a weekend now. Now, so it's not news that the strikeouts have gone up. But what I really would like to write about, and it'd be hard to get to people to really talk about it, when you're a kid and you grow up and you strike out, you feel bad. It's like, I think about Slapshot, I feel shame, you know, when I go back to the dugout. You're sad about it, you're dejected, you don't want to do it again when you get up the next time. Your dad gives you grief, your teammates give you grief. And when you go back up to the next at bat, you're thinking about that last strikeout and you don't want to do it again. So this modern baseball player that strikes out so much, if he is bothered by the fact that he strikes out so much, how does he get rid of that, you know, emotion to be able to go up and hit the next time, you know, 40 minutes later? And if he's not bothered by the strikeout, why not? Like, how did that happen? How did it not make you upset that you went up there and failed? So I've always wanted to do this psychology of the modern strikeout story, and I'm trying to find a place for that to live.
And two of the great sluggers from New York, you know, Aaron Judge and Pete Alonso both strike out a lot.
They strike out all the time, and they look really bad doing it too. But don't get me started on that. They don't learn, right? Like, you got to adapt. Grandpa, two days shy of his 40th birthday, he was playing with the Mets. He struck out three times on Tony Cloninger fastballs. It was only the second time in his career he had struck out three times in a game. And the moment the game was over, he retired because he was so taken aback and disappointed with himself that he couldn't make the adjustment, that he decided it was time to quit. I mean, that's crazy, right? And they're not making those adjustments. You see guys strike out over and over and over again on the same pitch in the same spot. If you can't hit it, stop swinging at it. You know? I don't know.
We're going to be going through a special part of the exhibit that's for the Negro Leagues. 2020 will be the 100th anniversary. And so when it comes to the way your dad thought about other people and people of color, he always was accepting of that. I'm sure that was passed down through the Barra family, because he was an Italian American. He faced issues when he was growing up. So all those values that, you know, dwell within this museum, they've all been passed down to Lindsay?
Oh, yeah. Grandpa was amazing. He, you know, of course he grew up as an Italian immigrant and, you know, experienced the Dago and WAP stuff. And I think that he didn't want other people to feel the way he felt when he was called those names. But really, I don't think he saw color. He didn't care if you were black or white or purple or whatever. And, like, you would see it, you know, in New York City in the 80s, when people were afraid to walk around in what they considered bad neighborhoods. Like, you'd go out and there'd be like a group of black kids on the street and you would see people get nervous. That didn't happen to Grandpa. He didn't register. And it wasn't that he was naive or something. He didn't see it. He did not see color. And he treated everybody, you know, regardless of race, for you know, race, social standing, whatever. He would talk to you the way he would talk to Gerald Ford, the way he would talk to his dry cleaner or the waiter at a restaurant. He just treated everybody as a human being who deserved the same amount of respect as any other human being. And it was really amazing to watch. He didn't have, you know, when we all make snap judgments about people, we all assess folks, and he just didn't do that. He brought the same, I don't know, values and viewpoint to any conversation with any person, and it didn't matter who you were. It was amazing.
And last of all, I want to thank baseball. It has given me more than I could ever hope for. And I hope that when I'm through with this game, I will put something back. Thank you very much.
He has to be the most beloved baseball player of all time, don't you think? Maybe Babe Ruth?
Yeah. It's crazy. We, with Grandpa, I was always just so amazed by him, and also my mother's father, who, you know, Italian immigrants, both of them, who went to war for a country that was really an adopted country of theirs, and came back. I told you my mom's dad lost a leg. Grandpa took some shrapnel in the hand. But what they went on to do with their lives after the war, it was like a whole second life, and they made these amazing, amazing lives for themselves. So I've always been in awe of that. But Grandpa, everybody, he was so accessible to all the people in New Jersey. And, you know, he would get his own dry cleaning and do his own grocery shopping, and he would talk to all the people in the restaurants and talk to the people at the ballpark. So everybody you meet has a Yogi story. Oh, I met him this time, and I saw him here, and he took the time to talk to me. He made people feel like they were the most important person in the room when they were speaking to him. And you sort of know that, because I saw him, you know, operate, and I saw him with people. But then when he passed away and we started to get messages, I was getting notes on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, in the mail, actual snail mail, on email, from people who told me about that one time that he met Yogi, and your grandpa was so important to me for these reasons. And they would say, I really loved your grandfather. And they mean it, love, in the same sense of the word that I mean it when I say it. And that is an incredible thing. I'm going to cry to realize that as that many people in the world, and who are not even in the New York area, love your grandfather in the same sense of the word that you love your grandfather. It's amazing. Totally amazing. Told you.
Hey, I would too. When my dad, you know, I had my dad as a guest on Sports Jam. He was a catcher. He loved Yogi.
They're the best people, catchers.
he, you know, he was thrilled that I became a catcher. And I told you that, you know, I've always been in awe of Yogi. I had the Heartland statue that my brother had of him with his mask. So when we think about you always being having that why and wanting to know, journalists, did you ever have a really deep conversation with him about D-Day?
I wish I had more deep conversations with him about D-Day, and also with my other grandfather, but they really, it was not something they talked about. I think that it was so horrific that it was something that they put in a compartment of their brain that they didn't access very often. And it was funny, we watched, first it happened with Saving Private Ryan, and then it happened with the Band of Brothers series on HBO, and I remember watching the Band of Brothers, the first episode, and I was with my dad, my grandmother, and my grandpa Yogi. We were in their living room in Montclair, and as the credits started to roll on that first show, grandpa just started talking, and I like looked at my dad, and he put his finger over his lips, shh, you know, let him talk, and it was the first time I'd ever really heard him talk about being on that rocket boat. When he did talk about it, you know, in most public settings, he really would just talk about, oh, it was like the 4th of July. Like, they kind of, it wasn't like the 4th of July, let's be honest. But they kind of chose to remember it in a way that I think they could deal with, you know? And so I didn't have too many, I mean, that's a very long answer for me to say. I didn't have too many in-depth conversations with him about it, and I wish I had had more.
Well, I understand that completely. For a few years when I was working at another radio station, I was a member of a Seaside Heights softball team that was comprised of all Vietnam veterans, yeah. And I really could never get them to talk about it. You know, and they expressed that. They all had their own memorial days, they would tell me. So, you know, being at war is just something that, I mean, first of all, how about the fact that he just came back?
I know, it's the fact that he came back, and so many people came back and went on, they don't call it the Greatest Generation for no reason. Like, they all went on to do absolutely incredible things with their lives after what they went through in Europe and in the Pacific. Like, I mean, war is messed up, and we see what it, now that we know what PTSD really does to people, and you know what a lot of these men did in spite of that, it's incredible. They were incredible people.
Did you record your interviews with your grandfather?
I didn't. It's I know, it's a shame. I should have. And as a reporter, I should have known it. But, you know, I think maybe selfishly what I was thinking was that Grandpa had done so many interviews with so many people, and there was so much out there on him, you know, and written about him, that the stories that I had left, I kind of wanted to keep for me. And maybe someday I will live to regret that. I'm okay with it at the moment. What I do regret is actually not getting more from my grandmother, because she was pretty special as well. We always say Grandpa was really cool, but it was Grammy who drove the bus. He wouldn't have been anywhere without her.
What was the best advice she gave you?
Gram was like, she really was like a second mom to me. I was a little girl, you know, and I was playing hockey, but she never treated me like that. It was, whatever I wanted to do, I could do. Graham grew up incredibly poor on a farm in Salem, Missouri. And it was funny, my dad actually recently had a conversation with her sister, my Aunt Mary Lou, who's still alive, who was talking about just how poor they were. And my dad didn't know that. Like, he knew they were poor, but he didn't know that they were dirt poor. Like, the house had no plumbing until Graham was in her teens. You know, it was really bad Depression era stuff. And she didn't talk about that. She met Grandpa. She came to New York. She became someone who could do the New York Times crossword puzzle in about 11 minutes. You know, she read everything she could get her hands on, you know, basically educated herself, you know, just through living in the world, and was just incredible. And I guess I just learned a lot about paving your own way from her. She was a special person. Grandpa was dating up, for sure.
And he probably admitted that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. Carm, the way he talked about her, like, if you would watch his face when he would talk about her, he would just light up.
Best day with Yogi?
God. I mean, there's so many. My best days with my grandpa, like, I would say, would be, like, sitting in the house at 11 o'clock at night and watching Seinfeld reruns on PBS, just, you know, shooting the shit about what went on during the day. I just liked, I lived in Montclair, and I used to play in a Tuesday night soccer league. And on Tuesday nights, I would go back to my grandparents' house after soccer and, you know, eat whatever leftovers they had on the stove and just kind of hang out with them. I was lucky that I lived in Montclair and got to spend a lot of those, you know, just quiet, normal grandpa, grandma, granddaughter moments with them. And even when I lived in the city, I would make sure to get out. It was silly. I was paying all this money for rent in New York and coming out a couple days a week to make sure I saw my grandparents. I think that I was very lucky, you know, a lot of us have relationships with our grandparents that revolve around, you know, Christmas gifts at holidays, and they watch you when your parents can't. But so many people lose their grandparents when they're young. And I was very lucky to have mine until I was, my grandmother died when I was 36, my grandfather when I was 38. So I got to have these grown up adult relationships with these people who were just such incredible humans that, you know, I could talk to my grandfather about anything, be it, you know, if it was problems I was having at work. I would talk through story ideas with him. I would talk to him about dating. Like, there was nothing I couldn't talk about with either one of my grandparents. They were really, they were my friends as much as they were, you know, grandparents to me. And being able to spend, you know, the little moments was great. But then of course, things like Yogi Berra Day at the stadium, like those kind of things were pretty cool too. But he was almost two different people in my mind. He was almost the grandpa that I had at home, even though they were kind of the same, and the Yogi Berra that you saw on TV. I had to be like, oh, no, he's Yogi Berra today, you know?
And just the fact that, you know, we talked about how my father was a catcher. My dad's name was Francis, but nobody calls him Francis. They call him Spike.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Exactly. And your grandfather's name is Lawrence, but nobody called him Lawrence. They called him Yogi. For very kind of strange reasons, too. For my dad, somebody saw him fighting and told my my grandfather, boy, he can handle himself. I'm going to start calling him Spike. It's stuck now for 90 years.
Right. Grandpa's nickname, somebody, I think it was, so there's two different versions of the story. One says it was an American Legion ball when he was like 16 or 17, and the other is he was with the Norfolk Tars before the war, and he used to stand in the on deck circle with his arms crossed across his chest, and somebody had seen a movie that took place in India, I would speculate that it was Gunga Din, and he said, you sit like one of those yogis, and it stuck. And it's, you know, people think he was named after Yogi Berra, but in reality it's the reverse. Yogi Berra was named after Grandpa. People always ask me if he got any money. He didn't, because it wasn't his real name and nicknames weren't copyrighted at the time. We can answer everybody's questions in one fell swoop. But yeah, most people called him Yogi. My grandmother called him Yogi. The only person who really didn't all the time was Joe Garagiola. When Grandpa was growing up as a kid, his mother couldn't say Larry. It came out Laudie, like that, like a rolled R. So Laudie became his childhood nickname, and Joe Garagiola would call him on the phone and ask for Laudie. And sometimes would call him Lawrence as well. But he also called him Yogi. But Joe was really the only one who went back to Larry. We have some baseball cards here, too. In 1951 and 52, Grandpa was still signing his name, Larry Berra. And then it became Larry Yogi Berra with Yogi in quotes. And then it kind of morphed into just Yogi over the years.
Well, what do you know? Larry Berra, they call him Yogi. His very first time at the plate in the major leagues against the A's. And what does he do? He hits a home run.
Best present you ever got from either Grandma or Grandpa?
Grandpa used to sign his Christmas cards to us, Yogi Berra. Or sometimes he would write Grandpa Yogi. My grandparents were really, I mean, my grandmother did the shopping, but they were really good at knowing each individual grandkid. And I rode horses my whole life, and my grandmother used to give me my riding lessons for Christmas. So she was on the experience wagon, you know, giving experience as a gift as opposed to a thing before that was a thing. I'm trying to think if there was any individual things. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of things that are sentimental. I wear this L around my neck that she gave me for my 25th birthday. I've had it on for more years than I can like to admit. And Grandpa gave me lots of hockey stuff, like skates and sticks and things like that. You know, normal things that grandfathers give their granddaughters, right? Skates and sticks, bats.
You consider yourself a role model, because I sit here talking to you, and I can think of a lot of people that would like to hear you talk about your childhood growing up, where, you know, your grandparents and your mom and dad allowed you to be who you want to be. And I think that's so important, especially in today's world, where no matter who you are, no matter what you do, to pursue what you want to do and yeah, do it to the best of your ability.
It's funny, I don't think anybody really says, oh, I'm a role model for other people. But when I meet folks and they tell me that I am, I'm like, oh, it's gotten to a point where it's, I'm not like, I'm a little shocked by it, but you definitely embrace it. You know, I go to Joe Madden's event, charity event in Hazleton every year. It's actually this Friday night. And the first time I went, like, all these little girls were asking me for my autograph. And I'm like, you know, if I write on that, it's going to be worth less than if I didn't write on it, right? Because I'm just writing on it. But and then I play in a charity baseball game in Cambridge every year with Steve Buckley from the Boston Herald, and the same thing up there. You know, and they see a girl in the baseball uniform, and it's just cool for them to see that. And yeah, I mean, I definitely think that you have to figure out what you want to do and do it for yourself, not because your parents or your, you know, family wants you to do it. And if you're lucky enough, like I was, to have a family that's okay with that, that's terrific. And not everybody has that. You're right.
One of the students in my sports broadcasting class, I had them all come up with questions for you, and they did a great job. But Mary Linda Hernandez wanted to know a little bit about the fact that you had to have your hot dogs only burnt when you ate them.
God.
And is that still the case? Hot dog, the big food at baseball games,
yeah.
The granddaughter of one of the greatest players that ever lived. Where do you stand with burnt hot dogs or hot dogs in general?
I don't love hot dogs when they are not burnt. I will not eat a dirty water dog off the street in New York, and I don't really like the ones at the ballpark because they're also made in the water. They're not on the grill. But Grandpa Yogi, who was an absent-minded grill master, which is why this happened, Graham used to get really good hot dogs, like from the German butcher store and whatnot, but they always had that black, like, crispiness, and it wasn't just like the black lines to make them look pretty. Like, he'd forget about them and they'd be like all black, but they were delicious. I loved them, and if I'm gonna eat a hot dog, that's how I eat it.
And half and half in cereal, she wanted to know.
That one was really funny. That was a total accident. So this happened, I was in like my mid-20s when I realized this was happening, because I wasn't often over the house early in the morning. And I don't know what I was there for, picking my grandmother for something. And I see my grandfather open the fridge and take out the purple and white carton of half and half and start pouring his cereal. And I'm like, oh, Grandpa, wait a minute, you got the wrong carton. And Graham comes out from the pantry and she's waving at me behind his head. And I'm like, what? So I walk into the pantry and she goes, you can't tell him anything. You know that, right? Just let him have his delusions. Someone told him 50 years ago that it was called half and half because it had half the calories of milk. He thinks that he's on a diet by putting that in his cereal. He's not fat. Let him have his delusions. I'm like, oh my God, he's basically putting cream in his cereal and he thinks it's healthy. Like, good God, no. But I didn't say anything because she's right. He wasn't fat. He worked out every day.
Not too close. What do you think? I got that insurance?
What insurance is that, Yogi?
Aflac. The one you really need to have. If you don't have it, that's why you need it.
Need what?
Aflac. Well, if you get hurt and miss work, it won't hurt to miss work.
Uh-huh.
And they give you cash, which is just as good as money.
Do you have a favorite yogiism?
I like the more existential ones, like, if the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. The future ain't what it used to be. In my family, the one you come to a fork in the road, take it, has kind of been shortened to sort of take the fork. And take the fork has sort of become a euphemism for, like, get off your butt and do it, you know? Like, what are you waiting for? Take the fork, right? Even though we know the fork was down the street from the house and he was giving Phil Rizzuto directions and they both went to the same place, so take the fork, you know, whatever. But yeah, Grandpa had this really interesting way of looking at the world. There wasn't, like I said, he didn't see color. There wasn't a lot of nuance, right? Like, things were black or white, right or wrong. You know, it was always very obvious to him what needed to be done. And he called it like he saw it. And a lot of those yogiisms are just him pointing out the very obvious thing that is so obvious you often can't see it. So if you needed advice about things, if you were having a problem, it was always great to go to Grandpa and he would tell you and you'd be like, oh yeah, duh, that's what I have to do. And most often, you know, the right thing is not the easy thing. So he'd be telling you to do the hard thing, but you knew he was right. You knew that was what you had to do. And he kind of just spoke in those yogiisms all the time. The one that people, that's like not famous, that people like to hear me tell is, I was doing a story on a tennis player who was, into cars and whatever. I come home and my grandmother used to dog ear or put post-it notes on all of my stories in ESPN the magazine so grandpa could find them and read them. And I come home after one of those soccer games one night and he's reading my story on this tennis player and he points to it and he says, "Lince, this kid is really good looking. You should date him." And I said, "Grandpa, I can't date him. He dates a swimsuit model." And without missing a beat, he goes, "You've got swimsuits." And like, he was right. Like, you can't argue with the logic. I do, in fact, have swimsuits. But in his mind, there was no difference between me and an actual swimsuit model because we both did, in fact, wear swimsuits. It was just the way he looked at the world.
It's lovely. I love it. I really do. I could talk to you for days, but I know that we have limited time. So I wanted to ask you one more question before we take a look at the Negro Lee exhibit. And that is, because some of my students refer to this too, is that, you know, you can have certain advantages by having a famous grandfather and having uncles and your dad played in the minor leagues. How much pressure did your dad and your two uncles have growing up with this famous ball player who everybody knew? Yeah. I mean, did you see it impact them in certain ways?
I don't know as much about how my uncles felt about it, but my dad talks about it a lot. And my dad is also very able to just let things roll off his back and not let things bother him. And that, thankfully for him, because, you know, every time as a kid my dad struck out, some jerk in the stands or the bleachers would say, "You're never going to be as good as your dad." And my dad had the attitude where he would turn around and say, "You know what? Neither are you." You know, so he was very good at letting it roll off of his back. I know it bugged my brother a bit growing up. I know I heard it when I was in, you know, playing softball. Like, again, you're not going to be as good as your grandfather wouldn't have missed that pitch, or, you know, just stupid things that people say because they're stupid. And
I'm jealous.
Well, maybe. And, you know, my dad always used to tell me, like, anyone says you're not as good as your grandfather, you just tell them that neither are they and move on with your day, right? So I don't know that I felt, I always felt less pressure on the athletic field and more pressure just to be a good human. I mean, that's a high bar that he set, you know? And I think, I'm going to cry here too, but I always tell people, like, if you try, you think you have those bracelets, what would Jesus do? I would say, what would Grandpa do? You can say, what would Yogi do? Like, even if you just have it in your head that you're trying to be as good a human as Grandpa was, you don't even have to actually be that good. Just trying to be that good is going to make it a lot better, you know? Like, I always say, if everybody tried to be, you know, behave like Grandpa would behave in all those stress situations, the world would be a much better place. So I think the bar is higher off the field than on it.
You brought me back to another memory when you see how cruel people can get. Mm-hmm. I told you before this interview that I played semi-pro ball with Darren Mazeroski. I was the catcher, yeah, and he was our second baseman, the son of Bill Mazeroski. And when Darren would not hit, we would hear some of the players out in the field saying, you know, you hit like your dad or you're never going to be as good as your dad. In fact, Darren was a pretty good ball player and was actually drafted by the majors and could turn a double play. I just don't understand how cruel people can be at times with that. But obviously your dad and your whole family has been able to. I think that's a great way to look at it. You're never going to be as good as
him. By the way, who is? You know, you could say that there's never been a catcher ever in the history of baseball who is as good as Grandpa. So by telling you know, a random guy on the field that he's not going to be as good as Yogi Berra, like, what does that even mean? That's a dumb observation.
There may be something that I'm not aware of, but is the Lindsay book coming out at some point about the relationship with you and your family?
I feel like I've done a lot of interviews and I've talked about him a lot, and you know, I wrote a bunch of things after he passed for MLB, and I still am at the point where I feel like the stories that I have left that haven't already been shared, I kind of want to keep for me. Like, you got to keep something as a granddaughter, right? Like, it's not, you know, I was very happy to, and it wasn't, this is actually, you had asked me about my grandmother before, like the lessons that you learned from her. The way that she was able to share her husband with all of planet Earth, right? That was very impressive to watch. They had such a great marriage and such a great relationship, and she was so fine with him being out there in the world and being loved by so many other people, right? Because she knew that her relationship with him was rock solid. And I kind of feel that way about like doing a book and stuff too. Like, I'm fine that we've shared all this stuff about Grandpa with everybody else, but there's just a little bit that I'd like to keep.
That's a great answer. And Newark has its little piece that they can claim of Yogi Berra. He played for the Newark Bears, the top affiliate for the Yankees in 46, before being called up.
Yep.
And that was a time when the Newark Eagles were also a tremendous, you know, Negro League team. And so we have the Negro League exhibit here at the Yogi Berra Museum. Kind of all comes together, and Newark gets its little claim of Yogi as well.
Yeah, I have a Newark Eagles t-shirt that I love. I wear it all the time. And Grandpa, that when he was playing in 46, Jackie Robinson was playing for the Montreal Royals his only year in the minor leagues, and they actually played each other in the championship that year, and Jackie beat Grandpa. So Grandpa met Jackie in 46 there, right in Newark.
Branch Rickey wanted him to be, your grandpa to be, a Dodger.
Oh, yeah. So Branch, he messed up. He at the time, he was with the Cardinals first, and Grandpa and Red Shandiest and Joe Graziola, Red Shandiest also in the Hall of Fame, for those who don't know, the three of them showed up at an open tryout for the Cardinals at Sportsman's Park in St. Louis, and Red and Joe Graziola got signed, and Grandpa did not, and he was super upset, and Joe Graziola went around telling people, I'm not even the best catcher on my block, because they grew up across the street from each other, but Branch Rickey had it in his head. He knew he was leaving for the Dodgers, and he knew he wanted to sign Grandpa in Brooklyn. And before he could get to Brooklyn and get that done, George Weiss zoomed in and signed Grandpa out from under him. So, oops, Branch.
That was a big mistake. Lindsay, before we head to check out the Negro League Museum, it's been such a pleasure to sit down with you. Like I said, I feel that we have this connection of the Pirates and the Yankees through the Mazeroskis and Bill hitting the home run over left field with Yogi playing left field and my dad being a catcher and everything. So it's been such just a real honor for me to sit and talk to you about this.
I this has been a great time, and I will say Pittsburgh, when I was a kid, my Uncle Dale was playing for the Pirates, and I used to watch him on TV in those hideous yellow uniforms with the black hats with the stripes on them, and he had that ridiculous 1970s mustache. But when I was a kid, there was nobody cooler than my Uncle Dale in that uniform with that mustache. So I was rooting for the Pirates when I was a kid, too.
Speaking of uniforms, let's go check out the Negro League exhibit. Thanks.
The count is two strikes when Yogi Berra slams one down the right field line. His second homer of the series.
All right, so we're here at the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center, and one of the exhibits that's here right now is specializing with the Negro Leagues. It's Discover Greatness, an Illustrated History of Negro Leagues Baseball. And we're here with Lindsay Berra, who is the granddaughter of Yogi, and she is also a board member here at the museum. And we just had a wonderful conversation about her career and her family. So let's... first picture we have here, someone that everybody knows and you've talked about before, Jackie Robinson signing.
In our Negro Leagues exhibit, Jackie played briefly with the Kansas City Monarchs before moving over to white baseball, the Montreal Royals, and then eventually the Brooklyn Dodgers. And we have these really cool iPad app that you can check out if you come here to the museum, where you hold the iPad over the photo and it makes it in color, which is pretty cool for the kids because the black and white photos don't mean too much to them. They might as well be looking at photos of the Civil War. But when they hold this iPad over pictures of Roy Campanella hitting and Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, it really just comes to life for the kids, and they realize that this is baseball. This is what Gerrit Cole is doing right now. The exhibit commemorates the 100th anniversary of the Negro Leagues, as you mentioned, and it's on loan from the Negro League Museum in Kansas City, very famous museum. And we're also doing some educational programming around the exhibit. We have a lot of school groups coming in, and we're basically teaching the history of race relations in the country through the history of race in sports. And bringing it right up to the current issues that we're facing today with racial diversity in America.
And you talked about how your grandfather, you know, was he treated everybody the same, but he was there at the era where that didn't happen for a lot of players, and that, you know, that they did face, the Negro League players did face a terrible situation as they tried to break in. Some didn't even get the chance to get to play with your grandfather because of what was going on. So I'm sure if Yogi was here today, he would be, these pictures would mean a lot to him.
They definitely would. Jackie broke into baseball in 1947, which was really Grandpa's rookie year with the Yankees, and they had met the year before when they played in the forgetting the league, but when Jackie was with the Royals and Grandpa was with the Newark Bears, they played in the championships. And Grandpa was always, he always made a point of going over to Jackie, saying hello to Jackie, putting his arm around Jackie, and I think he wanted people to see that he was totally cool with it. Later, the Yankees were one of the last teams to integrate. Elston Howard was Grandpa's backup catcher, and at the time, you know, that you're talking about the mid-50s, the South was still very much segregated, and spring training happened in Florida, which was in the South. And Ellie was not able on the road to eat with the Yankees in the white restaurants or stay with them in the white hotels. So Grandpa would often go with Ellie to the black restaurants and the black hotels so Ellie wouldn't have to be by himself.
You're using the iPad now for Monty Irvin, who I had the pleasure of having on Sports Jam before he passed. What a great ball player he was. Tell us a little bit about this photo.
So Monty Irvin was from New Jersey, and I mentioned before my mother's father, my Grandpa Dominic, was an Army captain, lost a leg in World War II. He graduated from Orange High School with Monty Irvin. Monty Irvin was, a lot of folks wanted Monty to be the first black player in the big leagues because he, A, was an amazing, tremendous player, but he had a very calm temperament. Jackie Robinson, as we all know, had a bit of a temper, and they knew that it was going to be a very trying situation for whatever black player was first, that he was going to be heckled from the stands, that it was going to be very difficult on the road. And they originally thought that Monty would be the best player, best equipped to deal with those kind of trying situations. And it didn't happen that way. Branch wanted Jackie, and that was fine. Monty ended up coming in a little bit afterwards and having a great career with the Giants. But he was terrific. And actually, his daughter, Pamela, was here for the opening of the exhibit. We also had Larry Doby Jr. here, Larry Doby's son. We've got a lot of pictures of Larry here. We got Roy Campanella. This Campanella one is one of my favorites because when you use the iPad, you can really see the vein popping out in his neck because he swung so hard. I don't know. I just think it's really cool. I have a lot of fun with this exhibit.
Yeah, and Don Newcomb, once when I interviewed Don Newcomb once here, the 1950 Newark Eagles Brooklyn Dodgers photo, it's him winding up and delivering a pitch to home plate. He still had the letter that he had sent to the Commissioner of Baseball asking that he be in the Hall of Fame. Because he thought since he was a Cy Young Award winner, he should be in the Hall of Fame. Larry Doby called WBGO when Gary Walker was on the air and actually told Gary that he was mispronouncing one of his teammates' names. And so Gary said, "Who is this?" He goes, "This is Larry Doby." And Gary was like, "I guess you would know."
Oh, that's really funny. Larry Doby Jr., is a great friend to the museum. He's also a great friend of my father's, and they've had some funny experiences because my dad and Larry have played on a lot of men's softball teams together, and people didn't think it was fair that Doby Jr. and Yogi Berra's son were on the team together. I guess they thought that the sons of major leaguers should have to be spread around the league a bit more, but Larry's here a lot, and he's a great guy.
Must be tough to control your emotions when you know you spend a lot of time here. But I guess it's also you're spending it with them too, huh?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I've almost cried a couple times in this interview. But it's nice. It kind of like, you know, and I'm gonna cry again. But we lose people. Everybody loses people, right? And it's a matter of I always said like you don't have to go visit the gravestone to feel him near you or know that he's around. And you know I'm lucky I have this place. But really, it's just talking about him and he lives in my head and he's. He's definitely with me all the time.
Just to hear you talk about him, I've told you before, it's really special. Thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
Thank you guys for having me.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production. You can check out all the shows by going to wbgo.org/sportsjam.
or you can find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on the NPR list of podcasts. Special thanks going out to the entire staff at the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls on the campus of Montclair State. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.